In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast in Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Our guest today is noted producer John Fields. Over the course of his career, he's worked with such varied artists as the Commodores, Slim Dunlap, the Jonas Brothers, and Miley Cyrus. But his reason for joining me today is his long-term relationship with the Dolly Rots. He's produced all of their studio albums, beginning with 2004's Eat My Heart Out, and he's also the producer of their latest, Night Owls, available from Wicked Cool Records, and that features our recent coolest song in the world, I Want to Lay Dead. I'll spin a bit of that now, followed by my chat with John on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for our coolest conversations. Joining me is John Fields, longtime producer for the Dolly Rots. He's also a noted recording engineer, mixer, and musician. Dolly Rots' new album, Night Owls, is out now on Wicked Cool Records, and it features our coolest song in the world this week, I Just Want to Play Dead. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, man. I was thinking back to when I was talking with Kelly Ogden. This was several years ago. She was talking about having recorded at your place in the middle of winter, which was very hard on her and her husband, Louis Cabezas, because they're Floridians. And it seems like your place was in Minnesota. Is that where you are? What state are you in?
That's correct. We're in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where it snows and is minus degrees all winter long. It's pretty brutal for anyone from Florida. I know they lived in California for a long time, so it was kind of a shock. But, of course, you're in the studio the whole time, so the only time you see the or get that feeling of frigidness is when you walk out at the end of the day, and it's thrilling, actually. I think it actually helps the music in that you're kind of stuck in a, you know, in a cave, if you will, because there's no sunshine or anything fun to do outside, so it makes the music, I think, you concentrate more on the music.
And that winter, does that the winter last from October to March? Oh, how long?
I remember a blizzard on Halloween once, but generally it's your November to April. It can snow in April as well, so it's pretty long.
Well, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Newton, Mass, which is, you know, a Boston suburb, which also had the winter, but it wasn't as brutal as this.
What took you to Minneapolis?
When I was a young boy, my Uncle Steve had the coolest song in the world. Sorry to say that, but it's true. In 1980, the summer of 1980, my Uncle Steve had a band called Lips, Inc., and he wrote and produced the song Funky Town. And So I had this cool uncle who lived in Minneapolis who was making hit records. And it was my first exposure, like, to knowing anyone at all who had anything to do with, you know, recording studios or songwriting or playing music. So he was my biggest influence. And when I was fresh out of college, I moved to Minneapolis to be with him and kind of take over his recording studio and learn from one of the best. And he basically gave me the keys and said, "Here you go, kid." And that was quite a long time ago. But that's why I ended up in Minneapolis, because this is where he's from.
Wow. All right. Well, I want to back up here then. So you grew up there around Boston. Did you take music lessons as a kid? Were your parents like, "Oh, you know, you got to take an instrument"?
I did not. I was a regular little leaguer, you know, just I tinkered on my own, kind of grew up. Started playing music like in the early 80s when MTV had just begun, and or like we got cable, I think, in like 82 or 83. So starting right then, it was just a full onslaught of just influences all over the place. But I didn't take lessons or anything like that. And my cool uncle in Minneapolis would send me a guitar, or he bought me a drum set one summer. Then he got me a little Tascam 4-track recording deck, which was a way to make demos at home early on in probably like 1983 or four.
Right. And, well, how old were you when he sent you the
14 maybe.
Okay. So and had you expressed any interest to him about?
Yes, of course. And he would come and stay with us in Boston for like a week. And I remember him telling me he's a younger uncle, I guess, if you'd say that. You know, he was, you know, he's only 18 years older than me. So I'm 10, he's 28 when he has the biggest hit song. And I remember him staying with us in Boston for like a week. And he remember him coming home one night and say, "I just saw the Cars at the Rat in Boston, this little club." It was probably like, you know, 1978, 79. And he's like, "This band's going to be huge." And of course they were. So he was the one who got me into the whole thing. And, you know, to be fair, the reason my parents were, you know, not pushing the doctor and lawyer thing on me was because my mom's little brother had done really well in music. Okay. And that was it's good to have an example of that around, you know, your parents, to at least ease their fears of, you know, what are you doing with this rock and roll shit?
In fact, I was wondering this whole time, you know, was this like your parents are like, your uncle's trying to hang out with you and your parents are like, "Now remember."
Nah, he definitely was opened my eyes to a lot of stuff. But no, I mean, he kept sending me records. Like, he actually produced a lot of records in Minneapolis, bands like The Suburbs, which, you know, on this label called Twin Tone Records, which was
right,
pretty,
I remember Twin Tone,
but he had done a couple Suburbs records and a lot of other local bands. And, you know, of course in Boston, my friends had never heard of these bands, but I would listen to them all the time and he'd send me all the records. And also he was in this peculiar spot of having like the biggest disco song, you know, of the decade, I would say.
Right.
But in reality, he's like a Beatles, Led Zeppelin type drummer guy. And so he gave me Beach Boys, Surf's Up. He gave me Marvin Gaye, you know, What's Going On, when I'm like 10, 12 years old, whereas all the other kids are just listening to, you know, whatever's on the radio. I was kind of digging a little bit deeper into Steely Dan and still was pretty bad at music, you know, playing, you know, pretty rudimentary piano skills, rudimentary guitar skills. But I was just so freaking into it that I just immersed everything I could into learning and listening and just became the biggest Beatle freak in the world. Reading all the books, Revolution Number 9, listening to it backwards, Paul is Dead, the whole thing just freaked me all out. And I got so into it, and that just turned, I mean, I don't know when it turned a corner, but it was probably when I moved to Minneapolis when I was like 18, 19.
Yeah.
When I got in the studio is how I learned, trial by fire. He just threw me in there with people. He's like, here, you're doing a demo with this reggae band. And it's like, okay, you figure it out.
Well, here, I want to interject this too, because I mean, you've worked with an incredible variety of artists. I mean, you mentioned getting thrown in and swimming there with the reggae band, but from like Slim Dunlap to Miley Cyrus, all sorts of
that is a wide, that's pretty wide swath right there. Just that was part of coming up in Minneapolis. There was a lot of, you know, remember this is the post Purple Rain Prince, you know, insanity. The Purple Rain summer was 84.
Yeah.
I moved here in 88, and it was kind of like Seattle after Nirvana and Pearl Jam. It was like every band was getting signed.
Uh-huh.
Everyone, you know, was kind of following this Prince wave. Anyone, the other thing about Minneapolis is because it's so far away from any other major city, I guess Chicago being maybe like a 7-hour drive, is that anyone from like the surrounding communities, North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, this is the place you'd move. This is like the big city for the Midwest, and had an incredible music scene, obviously, with the Twin Tone stuff and the Husker Du, the Replacements, the Jayhawks, the Soul Asylum. There was also this entire other side at the same time with Prince and all his offshoot bands like The Time, The Family. Let's see. He had this label, Paisley Park Records. So it was just a super vibrant music scene, but like on the super punk side and also like on the super funk side, if you will. And I was kind of in the middle of these worlds and had this kind of crappy studio, and it just turned out.
What is the name of the studio, by the way?
Well, there's been tons along the way. The original studio where I really started working was called Funky Town, believe it or not. Uncle Steve, you know, he called his studio Funky Town, and he kind of gave me the keys. So that was
Exactly did he give you the keys?
88, but we didn't have a 24-track machine till 1992, and that's pretty much when we started the Funky Town studio. And once I had a better, once I had a 24-track as opposed to I had a crappier piece of gear before that, but I was now able to kind of work in the pro world where, you know, you could work, people could bring their tape over and you could do overdubs and so forth. So it kind of got me in there. And to be fair, in the early 90s, you know, there were not that many recording studios. Now, of course, anyone with a laptop has a recording studio in their bedroom. So, but back then it was tough. It's like, you know, studio time, don't waste studio time. You hear all the stories. It was like that. And I was lucky to have this cool studio, and so I worked with just whoever came our way, and that was everything from seriously voiceovers, not even music, just, you know, like ad work.
Right.
I did jingles. I did.
We
jam
gotta pay
bands.
The bills, man.
Yeah, it was, and honestly, it was just it. I said trial by fire, but it's true. It's like, you know, I didn't really know that much about, you know, country music or anything like that. But then a country band would come in and you'd start working with them. You know, at the end of the day, it's music, it's bass, it's guitar, it's drums, you know. So, and I came from the musician side, as opposed to maybe more of the technical side. So I was more into like the arranging producer side, sounds, and, you know, like the arranging, I guess, side was more about like, hey, maybe you should play this bass note. Maybe you should not play that on guitar. Hey, maybe we should add a piano here. And I realized that's producing. And
well, you know, I want to get to those aspects of what you're doing in a moment, but you're talking about studios, professional studios. I know that when you first met the Dollarots, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I want you to, you know, elaborate on this story, but you recorded them at Capitol Records out here in Los Angeles. Is that right?
That is true.
All right. So how did that come together?
Okay. So I, after kicking a bunch of ass in Minneapolis, it was apparent that it was smart to move to LA. I'd been working there quite a bit in the late 90s, and then decided to move in 2002. and started immediately just working a lot in Los Angeles. And I lived there from 02 to 16. So for 14 years.
Okay.
And did a ton of, you know, a ton of work there. But the one of the first things that happened is one of these is I'm in LA and I get a call from a friend from Minneapolis who's a music video director. Mm-hmm. And producer named Rick Fuller and Phil Harder. It was like Harder Fuller was their name, and they had been doing music videos, big videos in the mid and late 90s, and they started moving into ad work, and they got a gig doing a Hewlett Packard printer advertisement.
Okay.
And of course I'm thinking, what do I have to do with this? And the guy calls me, he's like, hey, we're doing an ad and it's a punk band in a garage and we just auditioned this band and they're called the Dolly Rots. And I know you live in LA now. Do you think you could book a studio and record this 30-second song for our commercial that we're making? And it's out there. You can see it on YouTube now. It's, if you type in probably Hewlett Packard Dolly Rots ad, the song was called Feed Me, Pet Me. And the job for me was just get this band who I'd never met before into a studio and record a 30-second song. Now that should probably take like an hour, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
But of course, I didn't know anything about the band other than the name of the band was the Dolly Rots and that they were punk. And that's all I knew. And that they had guitar, bass, and drums. So I set up guitar, bass, and drums at a really nice studio. They told me there was a nice budget. So I had been working a lot at Capitol Studio on other projects, and I just got that happened to be the place that was free that day. So we booked it for the one day session, had it all set up. These three kids walk in from Florida and I meet the Dolly Rots that day. And we cut that song, Feed Me, Pet Me, probably within an hour. And a bunch of brass came in from the ad agency and the director and the producer and all these suits kind of came in and listened and met everyone at Capitol. And it was kind of a dog and pony show because, you know, it was a nice place to go. Yeah. It's got a lot of history.
Oh, yeah. A friend of mine used to work there and took me on a tour down there. And it was, I mean, it's just, you know, awesome. You know, the history and everything.
It's so cool. It. You're sitting in the room and you're like, wow, Steve Miller Band cut their song, you know, here. Or just all of it. You know, just you're it's
Sinatra. Sinatra's in there. I'm feeling the ghost of Frank all around me.
We were in Studio B, which is maybe the smaller of the two, A and B, but still amazing place. And so what happens is we finish the song, we look around, everyone thumbs ups the song, they loved it, and it's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I think I had started at 10 a.m. And back in L.A., you'd get, when you book a day of studio, you get 12 hours. So you get 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. And I look around and it's me and the three Dolly Rots. And we're sitting there and no one's there except us. And it's 2 o'clock and we're done with our job. And they're stoked because they had just moved to L.A. in their van and got this. They auditioned for this really weird ad, but they got it. And they were going to go shoot that in a couple days. But I said, hey, you guys got more songs? You want to make an album right now? And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, right now, dude. We got the rest of the day. It's all paid for. Let's just do it. And they're like, yes. So we sat there for the rest of the day and evening cutting their first album, which was, I think, called Eat My Heart Out.
Yeah.
And that was 02 somewhere, maybe. Maybe it was 03. I can't remember the exact date. But by the end of that day, we were best friends and we had cut, you know, another 12 songs, all at the expense of this ad project. And that was, I think, you know, a huge break for them. Just, you know, and me just meeting them that day. It was a great meeting of producer and band. They were ready to go. I was stoked with their material. I thought Kelly and Lewis were incredible. Their drummer Josh was awesome. They were really rehearsed. So it was like a classic thing where you just cut the song, you play it once, and then you rewind and double the guitar and sing the vocal. We were like racing against the clock to get as many songs done as possible that day. And they were up for the challenge. And really, I think it kind of changed all our lives that day, just from that weird freak meeting of my friends from Minneapolis who pulled me in on this weird Hewlett Packard project.
Yeah. So you've continued to work with them, and you gotta excuse me. I don't know whether it's like seven or.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a seven or eight albums. So somewhere around that. So obviously these kids made an impression on you. You guys keep working together. What is it about them that, makes you feel like, I can hardly wait till we get in the studio again for the next one.
Well, number one, I love the songs. So there's that. They were also doing it for real. And it wasn't like they didn't have like managers, and they were literally, I think they were 21 years old, and they had showed up in a van in LA, and I just wanted to help because I thought they were really talented. And songwriting was amazing. Kelly is an amazing singer. Lewis's guitar is just ripping. And they have a sound. I mean, there's no other band that sounds like the Dolly Rots. And I didn't know that till the end of that day. And then I realized then it's like, okay, this is awesome. And they just were wide-eyed and just up for anything. And they just attacked LA from this DIY punk angle. And I just really appreciated that and wanted to help them as much as possible. And so every time they'd say, hey, we got a bunch of new songs. Can we do a record? I'd say, yeah, let's do it. You know, it didn't take that long to work with them. Usually we work really fast together.
Yeah.
And then after doing a couple records, I think they signed with, Joan Jett's label. And
right. First one was maybe on Lookout. And then after that.
Yeah. And it just again, it's another lesson for, young bands and young artists if you want to be in the line of fire and get near talented people who notice you and people that are connected in the music business, you got to go to LA, London, Nashville. I mean, kind of New York is kind of over for that. I mean, there's still music business there. It's just, but if you go to LA, it's just like, there's so many opportunities to meet people in entertainment and the ancillary sides of entertainment. I mean, in this case, this was like an ad. So this wasn't even the music business really.
Yeah.
But it turned into a great combo of, where we've now done whatever, eight albums together. And I think they tried working with some other people, and I'm not sure. I don't think it worked out. Every single time they would just say, hey, we want to do it again. I say, let's do it. So,
well, let's talk about this newest one, the Night Owls.
Sure.
So, when did you record the tracks for Night Owls?
I think they came out here 2023, the first week of the year. I think they came out like January 2, 3, something like that.
Because they love that Minneapolis snow. So they.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Again, now, and of course, I've known these kids since they're like 20, and now they are parents of two children, and they got, they got childcare stuff going on.
Right.
And, they're the type of band that they bring their kids on tour a lot. But in this case, and the last few albums we had made with kids running around the studio, and it's fun. But this time they decided to leave the kids at home with the grandparents and come up here, just Lewis and Kelly. And we did the whole record in a week, probably that first week of January. And just, same thing. It's always, we're never like slacking because they've always got to go. There's always like a deadline and an end date. So we just try to get as much as we can done, get done in that week. And
so about that, let me ask. So when they show up, are the songs are already completed, thought out, arranged, or are you finishing things off in the studio?
But kind of both. There's a combo of both. I would say for the most part, they demo everything at home in Florida. They have for the last couple records. And, nowadays you can record high quality stuff at home. So they come in with, a couple guitars and a bass and a program drum beat and some vocals. And what happens is I pull that in to my session and I look at everything and we start just tearing it apart, keeping the good stuff, redoing the stuff that needs to be redone, resinging stuff that needs to be resung, but I will keep stuff that is done essentially that I think is great. Sometimes it's background vocals, sometimes it's all the guitars and the guitar solos. And So, you know,
are you also working with, you're talking about the nuts and bolts of the, what they've recorded before, but are, is this a point where you're also working out how the arrangement might be different?
Yeah. Sometimes they'll only have a verse and a chorus.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
But they've recorded it. They've recorded it with guitars and bass and singing. And now we need a bridge. Okay. So we, that's where we start expanding and saying, hey, what about this chord? What about that chord? And you're at that point, you're kind of writing in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a combination of all that. I mean, I don't think there was any song that I think there was like one song maybe that wasn't written yet. But generally speaking, they're all written or at least started. And then we've kind of finished them all here. Sometimes it's like, hey, man, we need a second verse. Kelly rolls into the other room, starts writing lyrics while we're working on something else. And she comes back in and she's like, I'm ready. I got the second verse. And we throw her behind the mic and she sings it. So it's very spontaneous. A great way for music to be made is that way. I don't love laboring on stuff and you know, over baking things.
Yeah.
So they are such great partners, you know, who are just up for, you know, wherever this may go. So, and they let me do my thing. Sometimes I have, you know, put my keyboards on there or have ideas for different weird overdubs, and they just kind of let me do it. And
well, let me ask you about the drumming. You mentioned they had bring in program drums. When you first saw the band, they had, you mentioned the drummer, Josh. But now, typically, you were playing the drums on their recordings.
Sometimes, it's been, every album's different, to be honest.
Okay.
So, honestly, it's you know, so, I mean, this is a crazy one. Lewis has you know, at the end of a record, I will make Lewis live, you know, they're called stems, basically. But, you know, I'll give him the multi-tracks of the last record we made from like 5 years ago or something after we do it. Sometimes he'll take one of those drum tracks, the entire song, and, you know, it's like, it's like a song form of a drummer who played on it. Say it was Noah Levy who played on the previous record.
Yeah.
But it's a 3-minute song for, you know, one of the previous songs. He'll literally put that into his program and start playing a new song to an old song's drum track. And just to get him started, just to be inspired. And what happens is he'll give me that, and then, you know, that will be almost like the roadmap for where this new song is. Then we'll turn those drums off, and I will either program or play new drums, or we'll get a drummer to come in and do it. And so a lot of different concepts there have happened over the 8 albums. We've used, you know, session drummers, or I mean, I wouldn't say session drummers, but we've picked certain people that we liked.
Okay.
That would be great to, like, you know, spend a couple days with us playing on all the songs. Sometimes I'll do it. Sometimes we actually use the programmed drums because they just sound so amazing. Mm-hmm. So really, it's a grab bag. Anything can happen in terms of that.
Let's talk some about this, our coolest song in the world this week. I just want to play Dead off the new album. You mentioned sometimes adding a piano or whatever, but on that track, is somebody playing like a Glockenspiel or a xylophone on it?
Yeah, that song has... So I when I started with them 20 years ago, you know, one thing I realized was they are like this perfect kind of combination of like Ramones meets like girl group 60s music, if you will. There's a lot of like Phil Spector-y influence in their writing. And so the first thing I think when I hear that, when they play me this, you know, Play Dead is what we called it the day they brought it in, I was like, okay, timpani, glockenspiel, piano, little, you know, strings, pizzicato strings, kind of those sounds from the 60s that they used on a lot of those records for Phil Spector.
Yeah.
And so I will just go to town, you know, and they're, as I said, they're super open-minded about letting me do my thing. I mean, they say no just as much as they say yes, but in this case, it seemed like the perfect, you know, opportunity to throw in all those spices, because it just has that vibe to it. It had it before even, you know, it had those things. I was like, I'm hearing them. So I started adding them, and turned out to be a really cool, you know, palette, if you will.
Yeah, it's a palette.
Yeah, to
very and, very tasty ear candy throughout.
Yeah, a little stuff. It's, you know, it's not that loud, but you know, again, it's still
it's there.
Rock it music with the guitars. And,
yeah.
But yeah, I love to add that stuff and you know, throw in those little, you know, tasty nuggets here and there.
Well, you mentioned Kelly going off the other room. Time to come up with some new lyrics. She walks off the other room, comes back, you know, a few minutes later. Okay, got it. And then is singing. You know, like the album's opening tune, the 5+5, the lyrics are about a couple in love and how one or the other may feel ugly at times, but then the partner sees through that supposed ugliness and, you know, is always realizing the beauty of the other person. And a lot of Kelly's songs relate to relationships, to the excitement of their beginnings, or the, let's say, the journey the partners take as relationships develop. But talking about her songwriting, can you comment on her songwriting lyric wise?
I mean, they're just so good, and she's so fast at doing it. I remember, like, you know, I mean, one of the times she was pregnant and she was here like two records ago. And we, you know, we had a lot of blank areas, and she's, you know, when you're pregnant, and also she was like, I don't know, 8 months pregnant, pretty, you know, toward the end, uncomfortable, but yet just pumping out amazing, amazing lyrics. And I mean, I think the two of them together, I've actually watched them kind of throw ideas around, and I'm just, yeah. I'm just like the fly in the room, fly on the wall. But she is just a powerhouse of ideas. And I think, you know, for their generation, just, you know, they're very pop culture aware. Uh-huh. And they bring all that into the music. And of course, you know, now that they're like parents and with children, I think it's really cool that they are kind of writing about that as well now. So I don't know. I love their lyrics.
Well, another favorite song of mine on the new album is The Vow. And I want us to go out on that one and the lyrics. And that one made me think it's pretty autobiographical to Kelly and Lewis. Any idea about that, whether that's the case or not?
I don't. It was such a whirlwind week when we worked on that record, mm-hmm. that honestly, I feel like they even changed the name of that song. So I'm looking at it, at the list, and I can't remember which one it was, what the original title was. So I'm not even sure which song you're talking about.
Oh, well, it starts off with... what is the, you like to say, what if Romeo and Juliet had stayed alive, not got dead, blind youth rebelling from nothing, and then goes yep. on to this in sickness and health and a fun.
Oh,
I love you,
okay. That was originally, I think it was called Sickness and Fun originally.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm just.
Well, specifically the autobiographical part is
yeah.
something about, they talked about a kid. She was nervous, wasn't ready. He convinced her one night in Paris, and then married
right.
with her kids.
I mean, that's what's so cool about, you know, a band making multiple records over, you know, their lifetime.
Yeah,
is that it's a historical record of their life and like what they're thinking and what they're writing about. That's like something you can buy into as a fan. We, you know, because a lot of their fans,
so,
I think, are similar.
So, John,
age.
The photo album has got a soundtrack.
Yeah. Awesome. I mean, it's so cool to have done, you know, I mean, it must be so cool for them to look back, you know, and have 20 years of 8 records with all these. Yeah, I think they were telling me, what was it, like 100 and it's like 100 songs more, I'm sure, yeah. of, you know, that they wouldn't have done at all had they just, you know, gone and gotten regular jobs or whatever. So it's pretty cool.
Well, John, I want to thank you again for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
I thank you for having me, Manfred.
All right. Well, we're going to give The Vow a spin now. It's the Dollarots off the new album, Night Owls and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
And you like to say, what if Romeo and Juliet had stayed alive?
Like milk, I go by in a flash, 'cause I like you.
The Dollarods here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with some of their tune, The Vow, which is on their latest Wicked Cool Records album, Night Owls. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the Dollarods' longtime producer, John Fields, for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. And be sure and check out our next Coolest Conversations podcast, produced by Hard Rock, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.